Hi folks, welcome to episode 52 of the Epochs of the Loadseaters. I'm joined by Bo, and we will be talking about the final episode of Napoleon, The Hundred Days. This is I love the fact that this is a thing that happened in history, because it's just one of those, you know, epic finales. And there's a part of me, even as an Englishman, who's like, come on man, you can do this. You know, like, you know, you are great. Come on, let's see this. So yeah, where do we begin?
It is funny that of all people in history, of all the figures in history, that Napoleon, on top of everything else, on top of the mad roller coaster, 20-year-long roller coaster he had, that you get this extra, just an extra episode of just completely unbelievable incredibleness.
I mean, it's literally like the end of a movie where the villain isn't defeated, really. You know, the villain comes back and they're like, oh my God, and they have to defeat him again.
Yeah, they set it up for a sequel.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. It's mad.
Okay, so after he is defeated at Leipzig and all the Allied armies get to Paris and he's sort of forced to abdicate, they as we mentioned in the last one, he's not executed.
To Blücher's disdain.
Yeah, and a fair few people actually, but it's sort of Castlereagh, our foreign secretary, sort of has among the biggest say. It's an interesting little point to note actually that back in those days, the foreign secretary could actually set foreign policy.
Hmm.
We're just not used to that, are we? We're used to a foreign secretary that's completely subservient to the prime minister.
Yeah.
Whereas in those days, the foreign secretary could actually, you know, you can't imagine Liz Truss has got the balls really to just start making policy.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? With all of these government offices, it really depends on the people who occupy them and the people who occupy the prime ministerial office. You know, it's one thing it being de jure, but like de facto, if you've got a very ballsy politician who's prepared to do it and, you know, make everyone else commit to it, then, you know, I could see it happening.
I suspect now we couldn't even change our foreign policy all that much without clearing it with the Pentagon.
I can't imagine we know what our own foreign policy is, to be honest.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So there's a touching scene when Napoleon first says goodbye to his men.
Yeah.
And he kisses the tricolour, he kisses the French flag, and he says, goodbye, my children. Yeah, it's quite poignant. I can't embrace you all, but, you know, I love you all. And goodbye, like, France is finished. France is over.
Soldiers! Of my old God! After 20 years, I have come to say goodbye. France has fallen. So remember me. Though I love you all, I cannot embrace you all. With this kiss, remember me. Goodbye, my soldiers. Goodbye, my sons. Goodbye, my children.
So just as a quick thing, this emotional relationship that generals often have with their armies is something we can point to at many points throughout history. I mean, Alexander had the same thing, Caesar had the same thing, you know, Napoleon has had this thing. I imagine people like Hannibal had it, you know, where it's a weird sort of, I don't know how to describe it, like a romance that they have with their soldiers, you know, and it must be because of the great danger and scale of their escapades, you know, that they've all been through these amazing, like, life-changing journeys, And so at the end of it, they're all deeply emotionally bound up with one another.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That there's the idea of the band of brothers, isn't there? Mm. That you can't get a stronger connection between men than that forged in combat.
Yeah. And we do have loads of examples of it.
Yeah, loads. So. Oh, yeah, loads. Loads of people say, like, the guy I shared a foxhole with, I can never recreate that relationship with anyone else ever. Mm. It's a unique thing and unbelievably strong. And that's just with brothers in arms, whereas an officer, sometimes officers don't care about their men, but lots of them, most of them, see them as sort of their children, their charges, and that they should younger look siblings after them. And or maybe like younger siblings or something. Which is funny because sometimes Napoleon was very, very callous with the lives of his own men.
Yeah.
But at least in that instance, he's supposed to be addressing the Imperial Guard, the old guard.
Yeah.
His favourite ones.
But we'll have to do an episode on it at some point where it's, you know, the speeches that these great generals, emotive speeches the generals have given to their entire armies. Their entire armies just back down. And it's like, you don't have to back down, you know. But there's a moral and emotional weight that the general holds. It has power over all of these men. But anyway,
one little thing on that. I think it's interesting that some people just sort of exude authority.
And charisma as well. Lovability.
So I was listening to an audiobook about Alan Dulles, the CIA chief from the mid-20th century. Someone said that he shimmered with power.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a great place.
Yeah, it almost, it was like a shining light around him. Yeah. And you couldn't deny it, and it was immediate when he entered a room and things. And you think of someone like Ian Duncan Smith or Ed Miliband or something.
No, I can't.
Not so much, right?
No modern. Maybe Tony Blair, actually.
Some people, yeah.
Yeah, Tony Blair, I can actually sort of see that about. Obama as well. Look at the recent thing where it was a thing with Joe Biden, and no one wanted to talk to Joe Biden. Everyone was crowding around Obama.
Yeah,
and
right.
You can see there is like a natural thing that some people have.
And of sort of kind of maybe obviously Napoleon had it in spades.
Obviously.
Like even when he's defeated, because when he's on when he's on Elba, he actually gets quite a lot of visitors, mainly British ones. It's like you can go and see the curiosity. Like not normal people, but if you're a...
But why wouldn't you want to? You're like, come on. Yeah. You know? This is the tyrant of Europe who defeated everyone and who finally met his downfall after invading Rome. Yeah, I'd love to meet him.
Yeah.
You know, who wouldn't? I mean, he must have some interesting stories, at the very least.
The Corsican ogre could go and visit him.
Yeah. But he wasn't idle while he was on Elba, was he?
No,
that's
not
interesting,
at all.
Isn't it?
So actually, apparently for a few days or a month or something, he was sort of despondent, but that very quickly passed.
Yeah.
And he started organising everything. Because, as we mentioned in the last one, he wasn't a prisoner there, technically. No. He was emperor of Elba.
Yeah.
And he had like a couple of thousand men.
Yeah.
He had
600 guards or something, and then like 10,000 peasants or something.
And they were like a small remnant of the Imperial Guard.
Yeah.
They were like crack troops.
Yeah.
There's only, like you say, a few hundred of them.
But why would you do that? Like, it's a weird... But this is the thing where they... Like, I think in the modern era, we just don't understand that they are appealing to a kind of... there's a kind of idealism here, right? Where it's like, well, look, he was the Emperor of Europe. He does have these Imperial Guard. He deserves to have a small remnant of it for his own, like... I don't know, self-worth or, you know, for us to respect the office of the emperor or something like this. There's something about, I'm not putting my finger exactly on it, but you know what I mean,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, you're right as well. Exactly right.
Yeah, it's like it'd be wrong for us to tear that down, you know? And so even, you know, we can humiliate him by giving him a remarkably diminished form, but still having 600 men and, you know, 10,000 peasants who are working the land, that's not the end of the world for Napoleon. He could have been put to work in a workhouse, you know? You're a kitchen scrub now, Napoleon. Get washing those dishes.
Or strung up.
Yeah, assuming he wasn't just killed. But even then, being killed, there's some honour in that. You know, okay, yeah, I was defeated by all the powers of Europe. Fine, execute me, you know. No, you can be a kitchen scrub. You know, you can wash, clean toilets or something. You know, there are much more humiliating things than being executed.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, more than that, they gave him... He had his own ship.
Did he?
Yeah.
I didn't realise.
He had a brig.
Well, then he's going to use that to escape.
Right.
why would you give him a boat?
yeah. So he's got like a really small army and not a navy, but he's got a boat.
Yeah.
And he's the not the palace at all, but the building that he's in is sort of not
it's an estate, right?
Yeah. So it's not a tiny little hovel or anything like that. Yeah. And he spends quite a lot of time squaring everything away, and a small amount of admin that is to be done on Elba, he sort of completely gets on top of.
Well, as I understand it, he actually went through a few reforms on Elba and actually improved the quality of life of the peasants on Elba.
Yeah.
So it's like, right, okay, well, if this is my little kingdom, I'm going to make it the best I can. It's like, okay, you've got to respect that, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, he didn't have to do that. But it's like, you know, I can make your lives better. Look, blah, blah, blah.
I once saw a completely fictional film once with Ian Holm as Napoleon,
yeah.
And in it's a fictional story, and they have it that he escapes from St. Helena and goes back to Paris.
How the hell's he going to do that?
Well, it's just just a jokey one. But pardon me. But there, when he's sort of incognito as a peasant, he starts organising the peasants just with as much vigour and energy as he always had, and it's just funny that he sort of for a while on Elba he sort of plays the role of emperor in microcosm. But one of the other main things he does is he keeps his eye on exactly what's going on in Europe and in France. And whenever he can get any word or any newspaper or anything at all, he's sort of keeping a very close eye on everything that's going on. Because he was there, he was on Elba for, I think, 9 or 10 months odd. And the problem is that his regime was replaced by the restoration of the Bourbon French monarchs, and people weren't particularly happy with that.
No.
And the powers that be, the rest of the great five powers of Europe, they had a so-called Congress of Vienna. Mm-hmm. So they all meet in Vienna to decide exactly how they're going to carve up Europe. But it takes them, well, they don't finish by the time Napoleon escapes. So it takes them months and months and months, and they're wrangling over it.
Yeah.
They feel like, all the parties feel like, okay, this has been a 20-year world war, and we're not just going to give in now over to the Austrians or the British. We can actually wrangle over everything.
And I bet they were squabbling over, like, you know, the territorial disputes of a small town somewhere in the border of the Swiss Alps and stuff like this.
Exactly,
like,
that sort of thing.
Like ancient European towns that really are not very important, but this is a point of moral pride now. You know, no, that is that, you know, this one has always been French, this one's always been German. It's like, but it's got 5,000 people in. Who cares? You know, why do you care?
Yeah, tiny little places in like Alsace. More than one people claim, and so they're wrangling over it all.
Yeah.
But I've got a couple of quotes here from Sir Winston Churchill about this period. If I could quickly,
changing
the view over to the British side, because as I keep saying, Castlereagh, our foreign secretary, was one of the most powerful voices. Anyway, Churchill says, quote, the war governments of these years have received graceless treatment at the hands of weak historians. Yet Percival and Liverpool, Canning and Castlereagh, bore the burden with courage and increasing skill. Castlereagh was now to take an influential part in the reconstruction of Europe. His voice was foremost in proposing a just and honourable peace. So there's the Austrian Foreign Secretary Metternich, and then Talleyrand, who has been around since the Robespierre days.
Yeah,
he was like kind of an important light during the Revolution. He's arguably one of the most important civilian politician under Napoleon. And then after Napoleon, he's still involved. Like,
it's amazing he hasn't lost his head.
Yeah, he's an absolutely fascinating figure, and he's a little bit of an underhanded, dirty weasel, but charismatic with it. I like to dislike Talleyrand. Yeah, I think that's how most people think about him. You know, he's the French. He's the enemy, and he is like not a great human being. But there's something about him where you can't help but
you've got to love a good villain, though.
Yeah, you really do. Yeah, he's a good villain. Yeah, and he's not completely evil or anything like that. No. Really, I mean, he's very corrupt, but. Sure. He's not an out-and-out, like, evil dirtbag. So he's, like, a really interesting figure. Really interesting figure. Another quick quote here from Churchill says, Louis, that's the restored Louis the 18th. Louis, however, represented at least a tradition, a fragment of the political faith of France. Above all, he represented peace. He was himself a man of mildness and accommodation. The years of exile had not soured him. The main social changes of the past 25 years were tacitly accepted. The system of government and administration created under Napoleon was continued by his successors, with the added novelty of a partially free press and the beginnings of a parliamentary constitution. End quote. So that's important just to note that even though they restore the Bourbon kings quite a lot, most of the really worst aspects of the ancien regime that the revolutionaries hated don't come back.
Yeah, so that's important. And they seem to be adopting a more sort of English style, British style, sort of limited monarchy.
Yeah.
And that seems like a reasonable compromise.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then here's sort of the key thing about how we handle the peace. Churchill says, a politic moderation was displayed in the terms offered to the defeated enemy. No indemnity, no occupation by Allied troops, not even a return of the art treasures which had been looted from the galleries of Europe. But the essential unity of France remained untroubled, and the territory over which Louis XVIII ruled was slightly more extensive than that of Louis XVI. To disrupt France would add too much weight to one or the other of the continental powers. Besides, it would kindle a flame of vengeance in the hearts of all Frenchmen.
Haven't they just lost millions of Frenchmen? I mean, what? So what? You know, millions of you are dead. France has now capitulated. Like, kindle that rate of flame of anger if you want, but we're going to start carving off your territory, okay?
Yeah.
I can't believe how moderately they treat this.
Yeah.
Like, they're so mild about it. It's like, well, look, they did just unleash a 20-year reign of terror across all of Europe, killing millions of people, burning down God knows how many cities. Like, it's been an absolute catastrophe. But, you know, they're the French. They can't expected more of them. I would not have been nearly as lenient.
Well, a lot of people, obviously Talleyrand is up for France being treated lenient.
Well, obviously, right?
Castlereagh, our guy, is up for that. That's his opinion. Right. And then the other sort of biggest player, the Austrians,
the Germans, are just like no.
Were slightly less up for that, but still. On that line. And then most of the other people, like the Russians and the Prussians, were much more hardline.
Yeah.
But just interesting sort of parallel to mention, because Churchill talks about it loads in his book, about the parallels between this Congress of Vienna, later to eventually it's the Peace of Paris, they call it.
Yeah.
That, to compare that to the Treaty of Versailles after World War One. The Treaty of Versailles was sort of famously very hard, quite harsh on Germany. I mean, Clemenceau said he wanted to squeeze them until the pips go squeak or something or other. So there'll be no leniency as far as possible. And that didn't work very well. Whereas this, after Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo and everything, it worked quite well, though. Apparently, Castlereagh had hoped that the peace would last for something like 7 years, and it lasts for over 40.
Okay, I'm not saying that they didn't get results.
So, right, okay.
I'm saying what they deserved.
Right, because your gut is just like, why are you being that lenient?
They deserve punishment. All right. But okay, fine.
All right, yeah. okay, another quick line here just to talk about Napoleon's family and his wife. They said, quote, the Empress Marie-Louise was allotted the Duchy of Parma, more because she was a Habsburg than because she was Napoleon's wife. It was laid down that her son should not succeed her. Bonaparte blood was to be barred from thrones. At Naples, for a while, Marshal Murat was left in possession of his stolen kingdom, but not for long. Soon the Bourbons were restored, and over them Austrian influence also reigned supreme. Yeah, it says, because some of them come out okay, like Salt, for example, goes
the one
on
from Spain, right?
The
one that
Marshal
was,
Salt. Yeah, he was one in Spain for a bit, but he was involved in everything. He goes on to be disgraced for a couple of years, but then comes back, is a Marshal of France in the 1820s.
Right, okay.
Becomes a politician, even, and lives to be a very, very old man. But anyway, another quick quote here.
It's just incredible that these people can essentially get away with it, in my opinion.
I mean, not all do. Marshal Ney is executed after the 100 days.
Yeah. But a bunch of them get away with it.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's very interesting.
We're still in a fairly gentlemanly,
relatively aristocratic sort of form of governance.
Yeah. Rather, put it another way, rather the 20th century is really cutthroat,
no
holds barred. And if we're used to that, if that's our benchmark, then this seems very gentlemanly.
It seems
but,
very effete. You know, it's like, what are you doing? I'm going to kill my enemy, then he wins.
they've took really seriously the idea that if you martyr people, it's really bad. Whereas we don't care too much about that. You know, we got Saddam, kill him.
Yeah,
we got Bin Laden, kill him. Yeah. It's a bit frontiers justice, that. But anyway, there you go. Another quick quote, and we get into it now, from Churchill. Says, quote, for while Congress danced at Vienna, and the statesmen of Europe replotted the map. Napoleon was brooding and scheming in his new retreat at Elba. Long before the wrangling of the powers had ended, he again burst onto the scene.
So just a, I bet the weather in Elba is beautiful.
Yeah, it's just off the coast of Tuscany, yeah. So it's...
it's got to be gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lovely, lovely place. It's like, well, there's 9 months recuperation and rest after right. these long campaigns. Probably did him the world of good. Give him something to do, organise these peasants. You know, go for a nice sail around the island, eat a fish dinner, drink some yeah. wine, laugh at, well, laugh with his old guard about the fantastic times I've had. I bet that was wonderful.
It's a bit like a holiday, really.
It sounds like a holiday. I would love 9 months at Elba, please.
I mean, yeah,
600 of my closest friends, you know.
Yeah, 9 months on a Mediterranean island. Yeah. It could be worse.
It? Yeah, it could be a lot worse. I'd send him to Iceland.
Apparently, there was a particular cliff that he could look out towards Corsica, yeah. and he did spend a lot of time yeah, just yeah. sitting there. There's well, a famous painting.
Famous paintings of it, yeah, yeah.
I'm hoping that's true. He did spend a lot of time looking at it. But he kept, as I say earlier, he kept his eye very much closely on the what was going on, the news. Mm. Oh, well, and he knew that people weren't happy with the Bourbon Restoration. Mm. He knew that... there was still he still enjoyed a great deal of popular support, mm. relatively. I mean, it waned, sure.
Yeah, but there's a sort of self-undoing, and then there's being undone from outside, and that changes people's perspective. Like if you undo yourself, I think this is one of the reasons that Trump is still wildly popular. Not just because Biden looks terrible, but because he was obviously cheated. You know, and if Trump had messed up himself, people would, you know, well, there you go, you got what you deserve. But when it's an outside force taking this thing away from you, then you do naturally fall into a sympathy for it. And the thing is, like, I can actually really picture Napoleon being like, right, okay, I've got 600 men in a boat. Things are not over. Like, I would, if I were Napoleon, I'd be sat there looking at Corsica going, yeah, this isn't over. You know, if this is over when they kill me, you know, that's what I'd be thinking.
Yeah. I suppose it is a good point to mention sort of how doomed all of this is, whether yeah. it was a legit, because some historians say he could never have won. Even if he'd won the day at Waterloo, eventually the Allies would have had some grand coalition again. But who knows?
Maybe, but maybe not. I'm sure that Napoleon has gone through lots of battles that they thought, well, he can't win this. And he wins. So, you know, I don't think Napoleon's the kind of guy you want to underestimate.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's just not the guy.
So some historians, not many, yeah. say all of this is sort of, pointless. He could never ever have got back to where he used to be. And others say, no, if he'd won on that day on the 18th of June at Waterloo, everything was up for grabs again.
I think so.
He would have reconstituted most of his at least early empire, and everything's back on.
Yeah, I would have said so.
I think that's fair enough to say. Yeah. I do think that's fair enough to say. But one quote that Napoleon is supposed to have said at this point is that the man of genius always gets back on his feet.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. And I think this convalescence on Elba, you know, getting his organisational skills back together, you know, recovering his confidence in himself, I think that this is it. This is the mechanism. This is how I'd do it if I were Napoleon.
Yeah. Because no one's really expecting it.
No, of course
it is
not.
Very, very ballsy.
It's great. It's hilarious. It's heroic. You know, this is the thing. Even though you might dislike Napoleon, what he stands for, what he's trying to achieve, you can't not love the story.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I can totally see why people, you know, find the romance of Napoleon fascinating and they're sympathizers of his. I can totally understand it.
Yeah. I was listening to something the other day and they were talking about, Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. Someone described Fidel Castro as politically fearless.
Mm.
I feel that's true of Napoleon.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, well, there's this crazy long shot, crazy long risk, which is politically extremely dangerous. And it's like, it feels like he doesn't spend a second weighing it up. It's like, yes, do that.
And if we win, it's going to be great.
Yeah. Because a lot of politicians, they're always sitting on the fence as much as they possibly can, really.
Yeah,
so here's another quote here just from Churchill, who says, but they, this is the leading nations of Europe at Vienna, but they were still by no means in accord on many of the details of the map of Europe, which they had met to redraw. After the exertions of 20 years of warfare, they felt they had earned leisure enough to indulge in haggling, bargains and festivity. A sharp and sudden shock was needed to recall them to recall them to their unity of purpose. It came from a familiar quarter.
See, I can actually completely understand why they think they've got all this breathing room now. Yeah. I mean, you would, of course, wouldn't you? But, you know, let's take our time. We can try and get the small details hammered out. This could be sorted for a long time afterwards.
Yeah.
It's been a stressful 20 years.
Yeah, you would think, just no one saw it coming that Napoleon would do this.
No.
And even if he attempted something like it, surely it wouldn't be successful.
Yeah. I mean, you did give him a nice island, 600 men and a boat, so...
Yeah.
I mean, what did you think he needed?
Yeah, yeah, like, what else?
Yeah.
Were you gonna...
Yeah. But like, you know, if I'm Napoleon, I'd be like, look, I have enough to restart all of this. You know, I'd be looking at the resources going, this is enough.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like, this isn't the case, but just it feels like this, as though they were tempting him to do it. It's not.
Yeah, they really weren't, but it does feel that way.
Yeah.
Why are you providing him with enough, like, nobility and resources to at least reintroduce himself?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, he can get back to France. You've given him a boat. He can move through the country pretty much unhindered because you've given him 600 elite men. You know, that's a lot of, like, 600 elite men go to any town, they can take it over.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, that's, you. And this guy is an administrative genius, clearly, and he's a military genius, and he's got a name. You know, he is Napoleon. He is, you know, he is majesty behind him. So it is like you are tempting fate here.
And those 600 old men are, let's say, old guard ultras, veterans.
Mm. Yeah.
They will...
Emotionally bound him through thick and thin.
God, yeah. They will do anything unhesitatingly, absolutely anything. A couple more quick lines here from Churchill just to paint the picture. He says, quote, as the months went by, close observers became sure that Napoleon was biding his time. He was keeping watch on events in France and Italy. Through spies, he was in touch with many... currents of opinion. He perceived that the restored Bourbons would not command the loyalty of the French. In February 1815, he saw, or thought he saw, that the Congress of Vienna was breaking up, the Allies were at odds, and France, discontented, beckoned to him. He slipped out of harbour in his brig, attended by a small train of lesser vessels. At the head of 1,000 men, he set sail for France. The Bourbons ran for cover. But the mood of France had changed since the high noon of Austerlitz, Jena and Wagram. Wagram was a massive battle, I didn't really mention, but it was a massive one there. He showed all his usual energy. He abounded in self-confidence, but the flashing military judgment of earlier years was dimmed. The gastric ulcer from which he had long suffered caused him intermittent pain. End quote.
Right, so we've skipped over a bit there, haven't we? There's a lot of time there. He sets off with 1,000 men and his couple of ships, lands in the south of France. And then word gets to Paris that Napoleon is back in France. What happens next?
Right, so the king, Louis XVI, has to decide what to do. So at first, he gets his best general, who happens to be one Marshal Ney, one Michel Ney. Is sort of the head of the French army, really.
There is no way, no way that a sensible person would send Ney of all people. I mean, why you'd give him command of the army anyway? Sorry, he was part of the enemy regime. Like, you know, like imagine putting like Saddam Hussein's second in command in charge of Iraq after the liberation of Iraq. You know, it's just like, or after, you know, the Nazi regime falls, who are we putting in charge? Goebbels? You know, what are you doing? Why would you do that? It's like, oh, well, Hitler's returned. Oh, we'll send Goebbels off to go get him. It's like, no, it's madness. Like, I don't want to say they've set this up. But if you were going to set it up, how much more would you make it in Napoleon's favour?
Mm.
Like, Napoleon probably couldn't believe his luck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? What, they're going to send Ney over? Okay, great. I can't wait to catch up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? It's going to be like old times, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You think when you look at it that they decided to send Ney, it's like, okay, I can't think of something more calculated to be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, send literally nobody. You know, send literally a nobody.
But their thinking is, or Louis XVIII's thinking is, we need to test them. Like, some of these old Napoleonic marshals are certainly great soldiers, so that's not in doubt.
Yeah. That's the problem.
You do want good soldiers at the top. But so if we're going to have this restored monarchy, we need to be able to have faith in the army. We need that. And so this is a test.
Yeah, but sometimes you'll fail a test.
Yeah.
And then it goes badly.
I mean, he said, Louis and his entourage were like, well, let's send the most Napoleonic guy as a test. And Ney apparently was supposed to have said, you can trust me, you can absolutely trust me.
Sure he would.
He was supposed to have said that he will bring Napoleon back in an iron cage.
Sure. But I mean, words are pretty cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, in the film Waterloo with is it Rob Steiger and Christopher Plummer, you know, the 70s film Waterloo, at that point when Ney says, I should bring him back in an iron cage, and then leaves the room, and there's a great bit where Louis is supposed to have just said almost to himself, like, nobody asked for that.
Marshal Soult, you'll keep command of our troops here in Paris. Marshal Ney, you will be the first to confront the werewolf. I know you love this man.
I did. Once. But I promise your majesty I'll bring him back to Paris in an iron cage.
How they exaggerate all this. The soldiers. In an iron cage. Nobody asked for that.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.